May it please the court, I'm Jack Mann of Kennedy Childs here on behalf of the defendants appellants John and Kelly Kelly. With me at council table is Paul Danborn, who represents the co-appellants Rick and Lori Zimmerman. I will confine my argument today to whether the issue of compliance with the Common Interest Ownership Act. I will not be focusing on the equitable conversion issue, but if the court has any questions on that issue, Mr. Danborn will be glad to answer them.
Very well.
I would like to reserve 3 to 5 minutes for rebuttal, but whatever time I have left, we'll just have to see how that goes. The Plaintiff Homeowners Association in this case brought this action to collect past due maintenance assessments from the Kellys and Zimmermans, but it failed to meet its burden to establish that the lots at issue were ever properly and effectively annexed into the Ryan Ranch Common Interest Community, or that the lots ever became subject to the covenants in the Ryan Ranch Declaration. Because the association cannot show, as a matter of law, that the Kelly lots were properly annexed in accordance with the Common Interest Ownership Act, or COIOA for short, the trial court erred in entering summary judgment for the associations on its claims for past due assessments. Let me just go over the basic facts here. In January 2001, an official development plan for Ryan Ranch was recorded. However, the Declaration of Covenants for Ryan Ranch was not recorded until March 2005. And at that time, only the filing one plat had been recorded. But the Declaration did not subject certain lots in that plat to the Declaration, namely the lots that were identified, the tracts identified in Exhibit D to the Declaration. Those lots, which included the lots at issue here, which were in Tract H, were merely described as annexable property, which preserved Ryland's development, or the declarant Ryland Group, their development rights in those lots under Section 205.1H of COIOA. In June 2005, the original owner of the property, Oxner Property, sold the property that contains the lots at issue to Ryland Group. Same day, Ryland executed a bargain sale deed back to Oxner for those lots, and Oxner also executed a deed to the Kellys for those lots the same day. However, these two deeds from Ryland to Oxner and then from Oxner to the Kellys were not recorded until 6 months later in December 2005. In the meantime, Ryland recorded filing two plat, which had a map showing the Kelly lots subdivided into lots where they had originally been described by meets and bounds. In September 2010, nearly 5 years after the Kelly's deed to the lots was recorded, the Ryan Ranch Community Association sued them and the Zimmermans, who purchased one of the Kelly's lots from a builder vendor who acquired it from the Kelly's, for past due maintenance assessments, claiming that the Kelly lots had been annexed into the association in 2005, so that they were liable for past assessments. Now, under COIOA, the exercise of development rights reserved in the Declaration is governed by Section 210, which controls over the Declaration, not only as a matter of law, but also by the Declaration's own provisions. The Declaration itself explicitly provides in Article 12, Section 4, that COIOA controls over its terms. And under Section 104 of COIOA, its provisions cannot be varied by agreements, and the rights conferred by COIOA may not be waived. To exercise development rights, COIOA imposes several requirements on a declarant. Section 210.1 requires the declarant, which here was the Ryland Group, to record what is called an amendment to the declaration that must do four things under Section 210.1. First, it must assign an identifying number to each new unit created. Second, it must reallocate the reallocated interest, or the allocated interest, which are defined in Section 207 as a percentage of the association's common expenses allocated to each unit. The amendment must allocate or reallocate those interests among all units, including the new units. The amendment must also describe any common elements and limited common elements. It must designate the unit to which each common limited common element is designated. And the purpose of this section is to satisfy the need for recording instruments showing the current resulting allocation of interest when new properties brought into the community, the common interest community. The fourth requirement of Section 210.1 is compliance with Section 209, specifically 209.6, which also requires the declarant, upon exercising any development right, to record an amendment reflecting the change that conforms with Section 209's requirements for plats and maps. In other words, either as part of or in addition to recording an amendment that complies with Section 210.1, the declarant must record a plat showing the change to the community reflected in the amendment that complies with Section 209. Finally, there's another requirement for valid amendments under Kiowa, and that's in Section 217.3, which is not only that the amendments to the declaration be recorded, but that it must be indexed in the grantees index in the name of the common interest community and the association. And the purpose of this requirement is to give notice that the property has become part of the common interest community and therefore subject to this declaration. Now, to effect an amendment to the declaration of annex lots into Ryan Ranch, the Ryland Group typically used a form titled Annexation of Additional Land to Declaration of Covenants, which is Exhibit E to the declaration. This form does everything required by Section 210. It is undisputed in this case that Ryland's practice and custom was to record this form whenever it wanted to annex units into the community, and it used that same form every time it annexed new lots into the Ryan Ranch community, with only one exception. Ryland never executed or recorded an annexation form for the lots at issue here, which are Block 13, Lots 1 through 7, Tract H, and these are the lots owned by the Kellys and the Zimmermans. Now, it is undisputed in this case also that Ryland Group never intended to annex these lots. This was shown not only by the affidavits that were submitted with the summary judgment motions from Linda Zimmerman of Ryland, from John Kelly, and the supplemental affidavit of Charles Oaksner, who conveyed the property to the Kellys. The intent is also established by the purchase contract between Ryland and Oaksner, which specifically excluded these lots from the property conveyed to Ryland by Oaksner. Now, the association hasn't produced any evidence of any specific intent to annex these lots into the common interest community, or anything that demonstrated an affirmative intent by Ryland to make them part of the community or subject them to the Declaration of Covenants. So what we have in this case is we have the form that was used by the declarant in every other instance to annex new property into the community was not used with respect to the Kelly and Zimmerman lots. And in fact, the evidence is undisputed that Ryland never intended to annex those lots into the community. So notwithstanding the absence of a formal recorded annexation form that complied with Section 210, as Exhibit E to the declarations in the form that Ryland always used does, or the absence of any evidence of intent by the declarant to annex the property into the community, the association has put forth a number of arguments about what it believes constituted the amendment that is required by Section 210. First, they argue that the plat and the bargain sale deed from Oaksner to the Kellys constitute the amendment. Then it was pointed out that perhaps the declaration may not comply with Kiowa in that regard. They argued that the filing to plat was the amendment. Then they argued that the plat, the original declaration, constituted the amendment required by 210. They haven't taken a consistent position, and I think that's reflected in the trial court's ruling, which held that the declaration had been amended to annex the lots by the 2001 development plan, which was filed 4 years before the declaration, by the March 2005 declaration, by the June 2005 special warranty deed from Oaksner to Ryland, and by the November 2005 filing to plat. The trial court held that, taken as a whole, all these documents together constituted the amendment that was required by Section 210.1. Well, obviously, a development plan recorded 4 years before the declaration can't be an amendment to a document that didn't even exist at the time. The term amendment clearly connotes an event subsequent in time to the instrument being amended. For this reason, well, the declaration can't be its own amendment. Otherwise, there would be no point in having Section 210.1 provide information that would already be provided or perform acts that were already performed or provided by the declaration. So this leaves only the filing two plat and the June 2005 special warranty deed as the possible amendment to the declaration. But neither of these instruments complies with section 210(1). The deed has no reference to a reallocation of allocated interest or allocation of limited common elements, nor does it assign an identifying number to any of the new units created. Well, the filing two plat does assign unit numbers to the new units and arguably complies with section 209(1) and 209(2) as required by section 209(6), it still does not do what section 210 requires from an amendment, especially when you compare it to the standard annexation form that Ryland always used. And more to the point, and this is an issue that the trial court never even addressed, even though it was repeatedly raised, neither the filing two plat nor the special warranty deed complied with section 217(3) because neither was recorded in the grantee's index in the name of the community and the association. Again, this is undisputed, but the trial court completely overlooked this instance of statutory noncompliance and then didn't even address in its order.
Mr. Mann, does it matter that the title search, regardless of whether it's properly indexed, title search has nevertheless brought up all these documents?
Well, I think that's what the trial court relied on. The trial court treated it as kind of a notice issue, which is, well, you had notice of this, therefore, we're going to excuse statutory noncompliance. But as against the rest of the world, that's the purpose of this, is to give notice that the property is in the name of the association and the community's grantee. If it's in someone else's name, it does not serve that purpose. And again, what that essentially the trial court is saying is, well, the requirements of the Kiowa can be waived when the act itself does not allow that to occur.
So the court was saying that the fact that there's some kind of actual notice or inquiry notice can substitute, in your view, for the findings of this under the statute?
I think that's what the trial court was trying to say. The trial court was saying, well, you people, you had notice of this. Of course, there was no notice to the Kellys. The only evidence that came up showed notice to the Zimmermans, but there was nothing that showed that the Kellys would have had notice of that, because the title search when they bought the property didn't turn that up. Again, that does not excuse the non-compliance with the statute because it has a broader purpose than beyond just the parties to the particular case. Now, one of the arguments that the association made in the trial court was that, well, it doesn't matter if these other documents weren't amendments because the declaration allowed this kind of automatic annexation when you have a file a plat and you record a deed from the declarant to a third party. But that's not what Kiowa requires. Only if that deed from the declarant to the third party otherwise complied with section 210 would that be a valid amendment under Kiowa. But here it's undisputed that it didn't. And with that said, if there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. We would ask that the trial court judgment be reversed and remanded with directions to enter judgment for the Kellys and the Zimmermans on the association's claim for breach of contract and unpaid assessments. Thank you.
May it please the court, Jesse Witt for the Ryan Ranch Community Association. With my time today, I'd like to focus on a couple of issues. First, whether the annexation of the Kelly lots required an exercise of reserve development rights, and secondly, whether the process set forth in the Declaration of Covenants Conditions and Restrictions, or CC&Rs, was valid under Kiowa.
Can we stop the clock for just a second? Someone has an electronic device that is interfering with our microphone system. So please, anything that receives email or gets any kind of electronic communication needs to be turned off. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
With regard to the question of whether annexation under the CC&R involved an exercise of special declarant rights, that's an important threshold question because Section 210, which was discussed at length by Mr. Mann, never says annexation. Nothing in that provision of the statute of Iowa deals specifically with annexation, or says that you must have a Section 210 amendment in order to annex property. Section 210 only applies when a declarant, such as Ryland, wants to exercise development rights that it had previously reserved under provisions of Section 205.H.
Mr. Witt, doesn't the statute elsewhere define annexation to be a development right?
It lists that as a possible right that the declarant may reserve, but it doesn't specifically say that it has to reserve that or provide anywhere that it must follow Section 210 when doing an annexation.
So is the fact that the statute defines annexing new property as a development right mean that it has no application if the declaration has language that somehow supersedes that?
No. The issue here is this is not dealing with all development rights. This is only dealing with reserved development rights. So the annexation could happen at any point. The declarant does not have to reserve. Could do it before the reporting of the declaration of governance, could do it under some other method. It does not necessarily need to reserve that right under Section 205.1H. The reason that's an issue here is that Section 210 exists to provide notice to future residents of changes that may have occurred subsequent to the reporting of previous documents. So if the original document states that the declarant is reserving the right to annex certain property, then Section 210 could apply to require notice that that annexation had occurred. The reason it's not entirely clear here is that the declaration doesn't specifically phrase it in terms of a reserved declarant right. It notes that annexation will occur automatically if the declarant records two things: a plat map that identifies the units and a deed that conveys it to some other third party. And it's undisputed that those two events did in fact occur here. In November of 2005, Ryland reported providing two plat maps that assigned identifying lot numbers and all the other information required by Section 210.
So it's your position that because these two events occurred, Section 210 has no application?
I think it's a very limited application in this case. I think most likely Section 210 did apply to the reporting of the filing to plat map. That appears to be an exercise of development rights, but it would not apply to the recording of the deeds later, which didn't even have to come from the declarant. Those could come from a buyer of the property or any third party. Section 210 states that if a unit's created under its provisions, the declarant is the owner of that unit. So that doesn't contemplate a situation where the declarant has set everything up, sold the property to someone else, and upon that sale, the unit comes into the community. So I'd say Section 210 does not apply to the recording of the deeds, certainly. It arguably would apply to the recording of the filing to the plat map. And the reason I would take that position is that these transactions really did not add or subtract property to the community beyond what was already described. In the March 2005 CC&Rs, the Kelly lots were listed as annexable property and put the world on notice that these would become part of the property as soon as the plat map and deed were recorded. So there was not really an exercise of a development right to change the community to add new units from somewhere else or anything that really required further notice to the outside world. Now there's some discussion about the intent of parties and Ryland's use of an annexation form. I don't think there's any dispute that had Ryland honored its own 2003 agreement with Mr. Kelly to amend the association's CC&Rs to exempt his lots, and presumably also to eliminate the association's duty to maintain the property around Mr. Kelly's lots, then there would be no issue here. And that's actually why the association brought this case 5 years or however long after all this happened, is it had been maintaining property around the Kelly lots for an extended period of time, couldn't figure out why if these units were not part of the community, and eventually discovered that it had to maintain the property around the Kelly lots because the Kelly lots were also part of the association, they were part of the community. They'd been annexed in November 2005. The intent, however, is really irrelevant because it's undisputed that Ryland did not amend the CC&Rs. and therefore we're left with the original CCRs from March 2005.
Well, if you accept the premise that the intent was never to make these lots part of the community, you're saying that by the mere fortuity of a deed from Oxnard to Ryland, Ryland to Oxnard, they became part of it, regardless of the intent of the parties?
I think I'm saying that it would be improper to speculate about the intent of the parties, because had the parties brought this agreement through to fruition, presumably they would have also taken out the property that the association is left to maintain. As noted in the association's unjust enrichment claim, which was brought to trial court, it's unjust for the association to have to maintain property that does not benefit it, and really only benefits the Kelly lots. So I would disagree that it's a matter of fortuity that they happen to be brought in despite the party's intent. I would submit that there was an intent to do something else that was never realized. And as a result, the association had the poor fortuity, the bad luck of being forced to maintain property that is adjacent to its community but does not directly benefit it, and instead benefits these seven lots. And due to that bad luck or ill fortuity, the association is incurring these expenses, but it is not receiving anything from the unit owners, the lot owners that are benefited by that.
Even so, the thing that happened that made these lots potentially subject to the declaration, et cetera, was the deed from Oxnard to Ryland and Ryland to Oxnard. As I understand the facts, though, that was done without knowledge of Kelly. And I think it's stipulated that was done without Kelly's knowledge, right?
He testifies to that in his affidavit.
Okay,
so I don't think there was any conflicting.
So the only thing we're dealing with here is that transaction that was agreed to only between Oxnard and Ryland in order to avoid having to report the plat.
That is, according to the affidavits, why that took place, yes.
Couldn't the deed from Oxnard to Kelly be considered the deed that, together with the filing of the plat map, caused the annexation?
Yes, it could.
Rather than the deed from Oxnard to Ryland?
Yes, it could, and we mentioned that briefly in our answer brief. That issue was not presented in the lower court based on the nature of the summary judgment motion. But if this matter were to be remanded, that's one of the reasons why I think it would be inappropriate to grant summary judgment the other way if this court determined that there was some error, because among other things, the annexation was probably triggered by events such as Oxnard's deed.
I mean, according to the declaration, as soon as Oxnard conveyed to someone else and there was a plat filed, that was the annexation, right?
Correct. That would require a finding that Oxnard met the statutory definition of a declarant, because the way it's actually worded is the deed from declarant to a third party. But statutory definition of title is getting a little field of the issues presented in the underlying motion. But the statutory definition of a declarant most likely would include a party such as Oxnard. So, yes, it would be my answer to that question. Absolutely. If this matter had gone to trial and the court had found some dispute with regard to the way Kelly had been involved in this transaction, the annexation still would have occurred by other means.
I want to clarify something that I had difficulty discerning from the record, and that is what is maintained by the Homeowners Association on the Kelly lots. And it looked to me like it was landscaping primarily.
It is. It's landscaping and a large retaining wall. And one of the concerns the HOA had was long-term maintenance of that wall may be expensive.
And so the Homeowners Association actually does the landscaping on these lots?
Correct.
Is there anything in the record that would say that the citation?
There's an affidavit that was submitted with the motion for summary judgment. And to conclude with the issue with Ryland, the HOA has never taken the position that there was not a breach of contract there. There may very well have been. There could be claims involving other parties that are not participating in this case, but potential disagreements between Kelly and Ryland or others do not invalidate the association's covenants, nor do they excuse the association's own duty to maintain this property surrounding the Kelly lots and the co-commitment right to receive payment for that. Wanted to talk to close this out also about the challenge the validity of the filing to plat map itself. The Gellis and Timmermans have argued that the filing to plat map, insofar as it was an amendment subject to Section 210's requirements, that it also then became subject to the 217 amendment procedure of Kiowa. And then finally, that because the county clerk apparently indexed the plat under a slightly different name, this was invalid. We believe absolutely there was inquiry notice. The title search for the Zimmermans shows that the filing to plat, or the filing to, is referenced in the title search, and the association's covenants are also referenced there. There was actual notice and certainly inquiry notice. Likewise, although Mr. Manning suggested that Mr. Kelly had no knowledge of that, all of his transactions referenced in his affidavit deal with his discussions with Mr. Ochsner about getting this plat recorded. So again, there was inquiry notice certainly that this plat, the filing to plat map, was being recorded, and I don't believe there was any disputed question of fact that Mr. Kelly had notice of the recording of the filing to plat maps. He may have had some confusion about the legal effect of what that meant under the reported documents, but again, that's not a defense to the obligations under the contract and the covenants.
And so, as I understand it, your position is that either actual notice or inquiry notice defeats the operation of the statute?
I don't think it defeats the operation of the statute, but I think it shows that there was no prejudice and that there was substantial compliance with the statute. In the reply brief, the Kellys rely heavily on the Grando Golf and Country Club case and argue that Kiowa requires an absolute strict compliance. In the Grando case, however, that dealt with a different statute under Title 24 that specifically said that no annexation into a municipality would be valid unless certain criteria were met that weren't met in that case. But again, that deals with a completely different annexation process for municipalities, and there's a specific statute on point. Kiowa has no corresponding provision like that. Grenard also states that to determine whether there's been substantial compliance with the statute, the court should consider whether the allegedly complying acts fulfill the statute's purpose. Now, the purpose of Kiowa is set forth in Section 102 of the Act and includes providing a uniform framework for the operation of common interest communities, strengthening the power of homeowner associations to collect delinquent dues, give developers flexible development rights, and similar things. Likewise, Section 114 of Kiowa calls for a liberal application of the Articles of Remedies, and Section 203, subsection 4, states that title to a unit is not affected by an insubstantial failure of the declaration to comply with Kiowa. And these provisions read together refute the argument and reply that Kiowa provides for a strict compliance standard. These show that it's intended to be flexible, that there should be a substantial compliance standard adopted. That's also consistent with the Silverview case that Bennett cited, which concluded that in a particular case, a violation was not insubstantial, you know, an omitted time limit, and therefore it was invalid. The fact that the court there, a division of this court, ruled that the omitted time limit was not an insubstantial violation, again, supports the conclusion that Kiowa contemplates a substantial compliance standard, which in turn then, when coupled with the actual notice and the fact that it was recorded, it was found, there was no actual harm here, that is substantial compliance. In the statute itself, Section 217, states that an amendment is effective only upon recordation. Now, it goes on to state that it should be recorded or should be indexed in the grantor and grantee indexes under the name of the community and the association. Here it was indexed as Ryan Ranch Filing 2, but whereas the statute says that the amendment will only be effective upon recordation, it does not say that indexing is required for the amendment to have effect. So yeah, we feel there's no disputed issue with that at that point, and the trial court probably found that there was notice there, and so my time's about to expire. The court, like, I could address the issue of declaration and which documents comply, but I don't have time. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I still don't know what the amendment was that was the effective instrument that added the Kelly lots into the community. never anything to comply, about anything that complies with Section 210. The plat didn't do that. None of the deeds did that. There's nothing, there's no instrument, there's no amendment that is required by Section 210 that accomplishes what 210 requires that amendment to accomplish. You can't just rely on the declaration to do that, because there would be no point for Section 210. If you could rely on the declaration for that, then the statute would say, well, you can rely on the declaration for that, but it doesn't do that. It requires that an amendment do certain things, which none of the instruments that are alleged to be the amendment in this case actually does. Let me get to this newfound argument that Mr. Witt has raised for the first time on appeal that, well, it wasn't really an exercise of development rights. I think if you read the statute, it defines development rights as any right reserved by a declarant in the declaration to add real estate to a common interest community. That's Section 103.14a. And sure enough, the declaration in Section 12.5 says that the declarant may annex to this declaration additional property within the lands described on Exhibit D attached hereto. And it says until 10 years after the date of the recording of this declaration. Again, that date is near because it complies with Section 205.1H, which allows the declaration to reserve development rights. And then if you look at Exhibit D to the declaration, that includes Tract H as annexable property, which is the tract that includes the Kelly lot. So it's really clear that the declaration did not include this property within the community. It merely reserved a future development right to annex that property. Another interesting point that Mr. Wick didn't mention is that that property, Tract H, the future development rights reserved to, wasn't even owned by the Ryland until June 2005, when it required that property from Oxford. So to the extent that they somehow annexed property they didn't even own through the declaration, I think just has no factual basis either. Now, Judge Terry, you said, well, didn't the deed from Oxner to Kelly cause the annexation? Well, it couldn't have, because even under the terms of the declaration, the deed has to be from the declarant, who was Ryland Group. Oxner's not the declarant. And with that, my time's up, and I thank the court for your attention and ask that the judgment be reversed.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.